Liszt couldn't stay in Paris and continue to perform. He had to withdraw, in a sense.
I'm not sure at that point in his life that the musical advantage is so clear. There certainly are by the time we get to the Weimar period, when he stops playing, in fact, really, and dedicates himself to more serious musical ends. But I think at this particular point, probably it's still manuscripts in suitcases, and I'm not sure that's the best way for any composer, really, to work.
We left him running away to Switzerland, if you like, with Marie Dagu, and they had children together.
Three children. Blandina was born, she was born in Geneva. Cosima, who later became Wagner's wife, born in Como. Not on Christmas Day, she liked to say, but the day before, actually. Quite interesting, some biographer dug that up. And then Daniel, who was born in Rome. And listen, his children, yes, he's been criticised. He seems to get criticised for everything, doesn't he? Funny. You know, nobody criticises Bach for anything. Well, you know, why does Liszt get picked on in this way? But anyway, he does. It's one of those things. But because he and Marie Dagu split up not so very much later, if you like, the excitement of the romance had died down a bit, I think they realised their temperaments were very different in many ways. It was a great thing while it lasted. There's no question about that. It wasn't superficial. But she went back to Paris, and he was charging around all over Europe playing the piano. And the children were sort of looked after by this or that babushka or Parisian equivalent, and later Liszt's mother, who stayed on in Paris and after her husband had died, and looked after them. Granny was clearly a great thing in the children's lives. Did he neglect them? I don't think he did by the standards of the time. He always provided for them with his money, certainly wrote to them always. You could say that he neglected them more than he should have. Problem was that because of the rift between him and Marie was so great, it was very difficult to have a sort of rapport which he would have liked. But he seems to me to have been very fond of them, and when they did get a bit older and came to see him at Weimar, there was some. He liked having his routine disrupted by this lot. You know, they all seemed to have got on with him and with other children who were around at the time, from his second inamorata, Princess Caroline. She had a daughter who was slightly older, and it seems to have been a really rather happy, free-wheeling household. So how he must have felt when, first of all, Daniel died, age 19. Nothing could have been done about tuberculosis. And he was the really bright one, academically very, very good. Studying as a lawyer could have done very, very well. And then his marriage to Princess Caroline didn't happen because of basically intrigues by her own family, her own husband, and who all wanted to keep a handle on as much of her own money as they could, and complicated intrigues in the Vatican relating to this, but it didn't happen. And then a year later, Blandina, the oldest daughter, who had married a bright young lawyer in France and was doing very, very well, had a child, everyone was very happy, and then she got an infection and died. And that really did devastate him, I think. I mean, as if he wasn't unhappy enough about Daniel. The memorial pieces he wrote for each of them tell you something about that. And I've always got the feeling that those 3 years, when you get three hammer blows like that, something went out of his life. He was not the same. One of the reasons he took minor orders in the Catholic Church, I'm sure, was because he felt, you know, people who matter most in my life are gone. You know, one relationship's broken up, two children are dead. The marriage of the other one is impossible, you know, clearly not going to happen. He needed a kind of emotional center, a spiritual center in his life. And I think it was his way of reconfirming the Catholic faith he'd always had from very, very young. I don't think we can underestimate just how much the loss of those two children really did affect him. He didn't talk about it much because that wasn't his way. But it must have, I think you can tell.
Stephen, what do you think of the spiritual side of Liszt's music? As Malcolm says, his devotion to the church was apparent even when he was a child.
Yes, it isn't something that he sort of had a wild youth and then discovered religion in midlife, although he certainly came back to it in a very serious way. But yes, it was always a theme. But I think he even considered priesthood, you know, as a teenager, if I'm not mistaken.
I think he did. His father had considered it, and actually did enter a monastery and train for the priesthood, and then found, as many people very honourably and honestly do, that actually it was too severe and it wasn't quite what he was meant to do. So he got married and had Liszt, so I suppose we can be grateful for that. An only child, interesting in those days, large families, but Liszt was an only. So no wonder, you know, his mother thought he was special. I don't know how seriously Liszt thought about the priesthood. There were times when he was about 16 when he thought he did, but he was being a moody adolescent. And he didn't actually, when he was older, he did not think, I think, seriously of entering the priesthood. The four minor orders he took, they did not preclude marriage. I mean, he could have got married in that way if he wanted to. He could also have left quite easily. It's not like leaving the full priesthood, which is a very serious thing. So there's no evidence he thought of it as a sort of apprenticeship. But it was a statement to himself and to the world, and I'm sure he felt to God, about where now the center of gravity in his life and in his music was to be.
I feel we've barely scratched the surface. And before you go today, please thank my guests, Stephen Hough and Malcolm Hayes.
Friar at the Royal College of Music. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handy, live on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. And tonight, the BBC Philharmonic is bidding farewell to its chief conductor for the last 9 years or so, Gianandrea Noseda. And they do so in music by the composer we've just been hearing about, and of whom Gianandrea is such a powerful advocate, Franz Liszt. The orchestra's joined by the soprano Julia Doyle, the Women's Voices of the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra Chorus, for a performance of Liszt's Dante Symphony. It's a work, it took up a lot of Liszt's life. In his mid-20s, he was living in Rome with Countess Marie d'Agoult, and her literary interests, coupled with his love for Italian scenery and cultural heritage, encouraged him to write a Dante sonata for piano. Fast forward 8 years to when Liszt decided to end his concert career as a pianist and spend more time composing. He turned back to his Dante idea and to writing a symphony based on the medieval Italian poet's Divine Comedy, his allegory of the Christian soul's journey towards God. Liszt played bits of it to his new girlfriend, Princess Caroline Sayn-Wittgenstein. At that stage, he was envisaging a performance of lantern slide projections of scenes from Dante's poem and using a wind machine to summon up the winds of hell. Not enough money to do that in the end. But it was another 8 years before Liszt began putting the symphony together. He wrote to his friend Wagner he wanted to dedicate to him a three-movement symphony based on the three parts of the poem, Hell, Purgatory and Paradise, which would include a choral finale. A few months later, Liszt travelled to see Wagner with his score, or at least the score of the first two movements, Hell and Purgatory. Wagner liked what he heard, except for the resounding choral ending. He wanted the music to finish with a fine, soft shimmer, rather than a majestic deity. Liszt blamed Caroline and said he'd alter it, and that's how the symphony will end tonight, with the shimmer. There's also the story that Liszt was still intending to write a paradise movement, and Wagner dissuaded him, claiming you simply couldn't write music describing paradise. Well, like the Saint-Saëns concerto we heard before the interval, the Dante Symphony is a rarity in the concert hall. It's only had two Proms performances. I asked Gianandrea Noseda to extol the work's virtues.
It's very difficult for a composer to touch probably one of the biggest and the greatest masterpiece in literature, the Divine Comedy, and to try to tell something important, something beautiful about it. And Liszt could catch the spirit of Dante, at least from the Italian point of view. When I conduct the Inferno, the first movement, it really sounds like very anguish, a lot of anxiety, with the claustrophobic feeling. You are there, you cannot escape. Also, the depiction of the love between Paolo and Francesca, which is the midsection of the first movement, is so well-crafted, so tender in a way. And the contrast is so huge if you compare all the anguish of the damned souls. So it's fantastic. And the Purgatorio, the second movement, is really try to point out the way where we have to go. The last 5 minutes of the Purgatorio, the piece at least called Magnificat, is the end of a journey going to the paradise. Probably it's not the paradiso yet, but now we are sure to get there.
So now here once again comes Gianandrea Noseda to conduct the BBC Philharmonic in Liszt's Dante Symphony, beginning at the gate of hell with its inscription, "Abandon all hope, you who enter here," intoned by the brass to the speech rhythms of the Italian text.
Thank you.
Liszt's Dante Symphony ending on a chord that seems to reach upwards to paradise, surrounded by a distant halo of alleluias. That was just the third performance of that music in the whole history of the Proms, given here in the Royal Albert Hall, live on Radio 3, by the soprano Julia Doyle and the women's voices of the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra Chorus, Chorus Master Simon Halsey, with the BBC Philharmonic guest leader Daniel Bell, conducted for the very last time in the concert as his capacity as chief conductor by Gianandrea Noseda. Chorus and Julia Doyle right up at the top in the gallery of the Royal Albert Hall. Marvellous effect, as always, with that distant chorus. Well, if you've missed some of tonight's concert or would like to hear it again, then it's repeated this Thursday, 4th of August at 2 p.m. on Radio 3. And, of course, it's available on the Radio 3 website for a whole week from now. What a stunned auditorium after that Liszt piece. Extraordinary first movement. All that sound and fury signifying quite a lot. And then the gradual ascent. And here comes Julia Doyle, made her way down from the gallery. Seven bars, but very important bars. Then Andrea Noseda behind her, again turning to the gallery and the ladies of the CBSO chorus applauding the orchestra. It's a long distance applause going on there. And the BBC Phil comes to its feet. Gian Andrea will be going into the studio up in Manchester with them at the end of this week to finish a Casella CD, an Italian music series, the Concerto for Orchestra. He's back in this country for the War Requiem, Britain's War Requiem, the LSO. Also taking that to New York in October, and the Beethoven Mr. Solemnis with the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment he's looking forward to, and he begins his new job, if you like, as chief guest of the Israel Philharmonic. All that after the Streza Festival and a little bit of a holiday. But for the moment, he's taking the applause here in the Royal Albert Hall. Well, you can catch two Proms tomorrow evening live on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, and at their heart, the season's commemorations for the 50th anniversary of the death of Percy Grainger. At a 10:15 in the late night concert, Northumbrian small pipes player Catherine Tickell and friends put his achievement into its folk music context. And earlier at 7, Sir Andrew Davis and the BBC Symphony Orchestra give the first Proms performance of Grainger's hugely inventive suite in a nutshell. It's teamed with Richard Strauss's portrait of the adventures of another rascal, if you consider Grainger one such, Till Eulenspiegel, and Tasmin Little is the soloist in Elgar's Great Violin Concerto. That's tomorrow. Back comes a slightly weary-looking Gianandrea Noseda, but a huge roar and huge applause and huge stand bashing from the members of the BBC Philharmonic. I think Gianandrea, who's just blown a kiss at them, is, well, hand on heart. There's emotion on both sides. Members of the orchestra were telling me that in the interval. Things go better and worse throughout 9 years, but at the end, he's a fine musician, a fine conductor, and he's a very straightforward, nice guy. And that's important. Well, for now, time to leave the Royal Albert Hall for the calmer regions of Broadcasting House, where Jonathan Swain's waiting to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Martin, thank you. Martin Handley there at the Royal Albert Hall. And as he was saying, there's another chance to hear tonight's Prom again on Thursday afternoon, this coming Thursday afternoon, at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
The Proms is, as we know, the world's greatest festival of music, stretching from now to September like a note that's held and held and held. And I reckon the Proms Poetry Competition is one of the world's greatest poetry competitions, stretching your imagination from now to the closing date of August the 6th. What we'd like to do is write a poem, in any style, on a piece of music that's performed at this year's Proms. You can react to the music in all sorts of ways. It could evoke a memory. It could make you feel something abstract and profound. Or you could pen a sonnet on the way the conductor moves on the podium in the same way your Auntie Mabel moved as she hung out her washing. There are three age groups, 7 to 11, 11 to 18 and 18 upwards. I'm the judge, along with the former Children's Laureate Michael Rosen, and I can't wait to read your entries.
Well, now there's a challenge for you, and you can read more about the competition on the Radio 3 website. Well, in 3 minutes or so this evening, the Lebrecht interview. Norman Lebrecht talking tonight to the German bass baritone Thomas Kvasthoff, one of the finest leader singers performing today. That's at 10. Until then, an example of Kvasthoff in song. This one by Brahms. It's based on a Moldavian folk song. Nicht mehr zu dir zu gehen. Not to visit you anymore. I resolved it and I vowed it. And yet I go every evening. The pianist was Justus Zion.
Nicht mehr zu dir zu gehen, beschloss ich und beschwor.
One of Brahms' Lieder und Gesänge, Opus 32, Nicht mehr zu dir zu gehen, not to visit you anymore. The bass baritone Thomas Kvasthoff and the pianist Justus Zion. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 1 minute past 10. And now Norman Lebrecht with the Lebrecht interview.
Thomas Kvasthoff is probably the finest leader singer performing today. Not my opinion, but the view of Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, voiced in a previous Lebrecht interview. Kvasthoff has both the high intelligence and the talent for intimacy required by this most taxing of art forms. He can shrink a 3,000-seat hall into the palm of his hand, and his deep bass baritone voice has a velvet quality that lends comfort to the mortal agonies he evokes in song. He's a unique artist, widely beloved, winner, too, of the Herbert von Karajan Prize. Visually, the striking thing about him is that he's just 4 foot tall, with very short arms, the legacy of a drug called thalidomide that his mother was prescribed during pregnancy. Born in 1959 and raised first in a pediatric ward, then in a home for cerebral palsy sufferers, he survived against medical odds through an iron strength of will, a ribald wit, and the love and support of his close-knit family, most crucially, his elder brother, Michael.
He worked as a radio announcer in Hanover before winning a singing competition in 1988 and becoming a sought-after performer and teacher. As well as classical repertoire, he's recorded jazz for Deutsche Grammophon. He married a television journalist from Leipzig, Claudia Stelzisch, and became stepfather to her daughter. Last year, his brother died suddenly and his marriage ended. But there's a happy ending. We meet at his home in Berlin on a street named for a great philosopher, Schopenhauerstraße. Thomas Quasthoff, Schopenhauer, on the whole, was a pessimist, but he took the view that the world is what we make of it, an expression of human will, individual will. Does that in any way reflect your personal outlook?
That was one book in my growing period from Ernst Bloch. It's Prinzip Hope,
The Prinzip,
which I read quite a few times. And I would definitely say that this is philosophically more the direction I want to go, because, of course, everybody who is really meeting me the first time is a little bit showing. I mean, you are one of the rare ones who were really so natural and normal, but I feel that there is an insecurity in getting in contact with me. And I think that I got from, who knows, a kind of mentality which really creates bridges. Ricardo Muti said, of course, I thought so many times, how do I have to give him the hand? And then I met you and everything was gone. Yeah, I had the feeling that there is a normal person, only smaller. My wife is saying this also. I mean, Tommy, you are only shorter, but not disabled in a mental way or in any other ways.
What's your first memory as a child? Where are you?
The real first memory is really when I was lying in a cast, because my foot standing after my birth backwards and they have to
reverse it.
So I lay 1.5 years permanent in a cast, and I could still paint the curtains of the room, and I remember that the walls were yellow and there was a door with a window on top, and I was 9 to 10 months old and everybody's saying, you cannot remember this, and I said, yes, I can.
And yeah. Are you alone in the room, or is there someone?
No, I don't even remember how many we were, but I think we were 6. 3 beds on one side and 3 on the other.
Your parents hadn't wanted to send you to the hospital. They were told to by the medical authorities, who still knew nothing about your condition and were worried of infections and so forth. Germany in 1959 was still a very rigid society. Is that how you felt it growing up in Hildesheim?
Well, Hildesheim is a small city, famous for the churches and for the church music. And even in my house, there was always music. I mean, my father studied music too, singing, by the way. Only the problem was after the war, all the theaters were broken, and the stepfather of my father said, a very nice guy, what a horrible profession. Then he changed finally, but I think in his deepest insight, he wanted to give me the chance to fulfill the dreams that he couldn't fulfill.
As a singer.
I don't even also think that he would have the strength in staying in this profession, because I always say a nice voice is one attitude that you need, but that's not what you need really to make a career. There is a lot more. Good nerves, intelligence, and yeah, many things. And my father was really, with my mother, very, very supportive when they realized, even with 3, that I was able really only to listen to a record once and I could repeat it without understanding the words, of course, but I did. So they realized that there is a talent, and they gave me then, when I was 13, the chance to put this in more professional directions without any clue of the fact that that maybe would be a profession or something like this. It was really like my brother played table tennis and I sang. Yeah, it was a normal hobby, and we drove once a week to my teacher and I had my lesson and then we went home and that's it.
This thalidomide disaster, which in our country was fought by the newspapers, and there was some compensation eventually for the parents. Here in Germany, there was very little compensation.
Mm-hmm.
Did
we get 25,000 marks? That was all. Yeah. So
it's about 8,000 euros.
This is better, of course, now, because the rent is much, much higher up.
The rent?
The money that I get per month.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. And yesterday I got a letter that the money will be raised from next month on 0.99%. This is, I think, 20 euros. Well, what a deal.
This is the interest.
Yes. I mean, on the other side, I mean, this Contergan organization which exists...
Contergan was the German name for thalidomide.
Yes, it's always, of course, asking me that I should be on front fighting for this. And I said, you know, I would have a very bad feeling because I'm earning really with my singing and my professorship so much money. And if I would go, we need more money. I mean, we have to have people there in front who are really fighting for their existence and who really have big health problems and things like this. And comparing to this, my life is really, thank God, on very stable fundament, which is really very good.
Did your mother carry a sense of injustice, of anger, of rage against the system that did this to her?
I think all her life she felt in a way guilty, but definitely not because I said, why did you? Never. I think I showed her many times in taking her with me on concerts that there is no need to have thoughts like that. I always tried my best, not in school, but if somebody would have told me 25 years ago that I would have a professorship at a music university, I would definitely say, you're crazy. But I mean, I did. And I love to teach. And even if I stop singing, there is always a kind of work where I know this will go further, even if I'm not singing anymore, because I definitely will not make the mistake to stay with 70 on stage and going young singers on their nerves.
Politically, you're on the left. You've described yourself once as an old red fighter. Where does that come from?
Bruno Walter said, if a musician is not loving music and deep inside not really a kind of communist and activist for human rights, then he is not a musician. And I think Bruno Walter is really very right with this. I think if you grow up in a very conservative world, where very important was what the neighbors thinking, where these kind of ritual car washing on Saturday in a white undershirt standing in front of the car, especially with the education in the school, I grew up on a humanistic gymnasium where I had old languages like Greek and Latin, and we had really also a history lessons with teachers who were really modern and really progressive in thinking, which I'm still very, very thankful. I mean, I was 10 when we realized this kind of student demonstration against Shah Pahlavi and things like this, and Onuzok died on the street.
Yeah, 1969.
So, yes, yeah. And of course, we were very, very part of the terrorist times. And of course, there was also a kind of opinion. I mean, I was always against violence, but I could understand where that came from. Yeah, I mean, violence is never the right way, but there were structures in the state, also in Germany, which had to be changed. And they did. I mean, even the student demonstrations really changed a lot in the relation between the students and the institutions of universities, which was very, very good and very helpful.
And you were following this at 10 years old?
Not very active, but it started. I mean, of course. And I mean, my brother was 2 years older than me. So every Sunday we had this kind of violent discussions with my father, who permanently tried to educate the two sons to conservative young men, but he failed with my brother and me. And we were not really this kind of violent left people, but we had a very intensive sense for Gerechtigkeit,
justice.
And this is still going on now. I mean, now I'm a professor and now I see
You're that part in many of the ways,
No. Of course I am. Yeah, but I'm the freak of this establishment, I would say. But on the other side, I see that honestly, the students has more rights than a professor, in many ways, where you really think, okay, big change. But in many ways, for good.
In the wonderful memoir that you wrote with your brother, which was unfortunately not published in our country, you make childhood sound full of mischief and fun.
Yes.
That you were the one that made everybody laugh.
Yes.
And
still.
Still.
I love to watch and I love to, let's say, beobachten.
Observe.
To observe people. This is really very nice. And with the disability that I have, I think I have a very intensive sense in understanding people very fast. The way they look into your eyes, the way they behave, the body language. It's very interesting. I mean, definitely if I would not be a singer, I think I would be a psychiatrist because I think there are not many things which are so interesting than the human soul. And I think one of the reasons is really that my parents really didn't handle me like a handicapped person. Yeah, I was a child like everyone. I had a big mouth. I was a little lazy in school. And it was also not easy with my father because he was always very afraid that I make my Abitur. And because you cannot really work as a street worker or doing something with your hands. When I was 15, I didn't understand. Now I do. There was also a permanent pressure, really, also in school, which they never do with music. Which was very interesting. I mean, they always said, Tommy, it's your decision. If you work, it's fine. If not, with your talent, your decision. And finally, that was the right way in handling this because I worked a lot.
Tell me about your brother. I mean, it sounds like an almost ideal companionship between the two of you.
Yeah, we had a very unusual relationship. My brother was one of the most nicest, smartest, educated, persons on earth. I mean, I trusted him 100%. He trusted me 100%. We had similar hobbies. He played a few instruments. He was writing texts, which I sang a lot of. One of the songs that he wrote is also on my last jazz recording. And he was even there when I produced it with no hair and very thin. And it was half a year before he died. And so I lost not only a brother, I lost really my absolutely best friend and the person I mostly trusted. And besides of all, he had a big sense of humor, which we also shared in many ways. My mother always said, to be together with one of yours is really very nice, but if you are together, then it's getting crazy. But it was a mixture. I mean, we had very often very serious talks, but my brother was not a person who opened his soul very much to other people. I mean, I was much more expressive and opened, sometimes too open. But I learned, and we had a very, very special relation. It was a big shock when he died last year.
Did you fight? Were there jealousies? Did you envy his physique?
Between us?
Never.
No. I was always admiring him for his writing because I think still that he was really brilliant, a brilliant writer. But he had no talent, honestly, he had no talent to sell himself. And I always wanted to do it, and he said, if you do it, I'm angry with you because this is my life, and he was right. And I accepted finally because he was right. I mean, would I allowed an other person's really to tell me what I have to do? Very rarely. Maybe my wife or very, very close friends. But generally, I think I take my own decisions, which I think they're good or not.
You wrote the memoir together?
Yes.
Was that easy?
98%, yes. 2%, no. There are some parts in the German version, especially, where he was writing about other singers in a very, very, very ironic way. I would say even in a bad way, in many ways, that I wouldn't publish, but he insisted to let it in, and we had some arguing about it. But I mean, finally, yes, it was easy. Very easy. And nobody knew me better than my brother, I mean, of course. And I think he really attached my way of living and my character really very nice in this book.
Yes, he does. Are there more songs of his that you want to sing?
I just got a recording from his songs, and we will see. We anyway will have some serious talks with the DG and checking where the way is going. I had a big wish to make one kind of country recording, which I think would be really very nice. You know, I love to...
Thomas Quasthoff meets Johnny Cash?
No, I would not say that. But, you know, I was never a kind of artist who said only classical music is the music. I mean, I love the music, and of course I love Bach and Schubert and Schumann and Brahms and Wolf and everything. But I was always interested in so many other things in literature. And it was really very nice because I had a larynx infection in the last 5 weeks. And all my colleagues said, oh God, you have to stop singing for 5 weeks. And I said, you know what? I bought myself a Kindle thing. And I was sitting here and I was reading 5 weeks. I never had the chance really to read in 5 weeks so many books. I loved it. And I cannot remember in the last 15 years that I was at home for 5 weeks, which was very nice. And you know what? With 51, I'm coming to a point in my life where I say everybody is replaceable. Yeah, the music world is not breaking together if Thomas Quasthoff is not singing. Maybe I'm important for some people who love me, but let's be honest. I mean, the musical world is a very superficial world in many ways. And to be a part of it, it's in a way nice, but I think that I'm not really addicted to it anymore. I love to sing, but if I have not to sing, it's also okay.
Are you aware of the presence that you have on stage, how you dominate a stage? I mean, I've seen you in Salzburg in a großes Festspielhaus recital with Andras Schiff, and all around me were completely unaware of him. Everything was focused on you. You have this magnetism on stage.
I think it would be really dangerous if I would know it. Then maybe I would use it more. No, I don't think so. And I think charisma is not learnable. You have it or you don't have it. I can teach a student a vocal technique. I can teach a kind of presence on stage. But charisma you cannot really teach. And thank God I have this talent. I mean, I just had this wonderful example. We had a gala concert from my university where a young singer sang Ella Ja Mai Mama from Don Carlos, where this long prelude orchestral introduction is played, and he was standing honestly like this for 5 minutes, so there was nothing in his face, zero, where I said, how is this possible? I mean, if you sing, if you're going to sing, she never loved me, and I don't see this in the face, then something is wrong.
Oh, you do feel that even if it was in the dark and there was no limelight, that you would somehow still attract the limelight.
I mean, there are some instruments that you can use on stage, which is really helping to create a kind of concentration. I mean, for example, to look to one person's eyes, not in the first row, but in the middle, and you're focusing on one person, and it's really giving and creating a feeling that everybody has the feeling that you are meaning him or her, and it works. And the second thing is, I think it's very interesting to create a kinesthetic space on stage. That means to create a space and to sing so impressive and so imaginative that it doesn't matter in what language you sing, the people have to understand what you are singing about. One of the nicest examples I always have is I had a masterclass in Salzburg, and one student was singing the trout, the Forelle. And he came on stage and I sang, in einem Bächlein helle, like this. And his face was really up. So I had a key in my hand from the room where I taught, and I smashed it on the floor. And suddenly he did this. I said, exactly. You are not honestly singing about flying fishes. And even if your eye moving. It's not quiet. A trout is doing this. Yeah? Or you can sing duft, but if you sing duft, the audience really have the imagination of smelling something. The way you pronounce words. And I know that I am, in this way, maybe very different from other singers who are much more taking care of having this endless legato. I think Matthias Görner, for example, is an artist like this. For my opinion, this endless legato and smooth sound, the most important thing of his singing. My interests are more in the relation between the music and the language and coloring words, because I think that the human voice is the most colorful voice that you can have from all instruments on earth. So if I would only search for this smooth, that would be not enough from my point of view of art singing. So this is what I try to do as an artist, and this is what I try in making young singers searching for when they study music and when they sing.
Presentation is important. You've criticized other singers, your friend Ian Bostridge, for slouching on stage.
I think if you walk on stage in a recital a lot and even turn away from an audience, what some colleagues are doing, a concentration is lost. And you always see, if you have a Winterreise, for example, and you have these 24 songs, I'm really never let an audience go. Yeah, I really stay between the songs, which leads me really to a point always where you have, after the last song, this total silence where you can really can hear a nail falling. And this kind of concentration is what is, for me, especially in this circle, very, very important. The concentration is getting lost. On the other side, I think that especially my generation of singers and the generation which are really coming after us must think about a new way of presentation, because I really think that this time where lead singing is a synonym for standing on a stage with a frack and having this very serious attitude, instead of also showing people that even for us as artists, it's not this raised finger in, now we are showing you art. Instead of joy and fun. Yeah, I mean, I do, not in the Winterreise, but if I do recitals sometimes, I'm speaking to an audience or making a joke, not on low level, but in a very positive and high level way, a kind of entertainment. I mean, 2 years ago, I sang a really hardcore program for a Salzburg audience. I sang the Rückert songs, then I sang Jedermann Monologue from Frank Martin, then Break, and then I sang a piece by Aribert Reimann, what he wrote for me, 12 minutes unaccompanied, and then the four series songs from Johannes Brahms. So not really easy listening, definitely not. And it worked, but I also did a joke in between, and I feel always, if I'm doing that, a kind of negative tension is going away. And this generation of Hotter and Dieskau and Schwarzkopf, you know, humor, well, Hotter a little bit, but Dieskau, humor and recitals, I think even the humor was planned.
Would you like to see young singers change the mode of dress or use video?
I don't think that it's a dress question. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I would not like to see a recital in jeans or something like this. No, but showing that it's fun what we are doing there, showing that we are enjoying what we are doing there. And every kind of communication with an audience is putting us away from this statue habit. I mean, we had 3 years ago a concert in Verbier, I will not mention her name, by a very, very, very famous soprano. And I admired her always so very much. But then if you realize that the voice is not there anymore, but the habit is really the habit of a diva, then I have problems with this. Yeah, and the presentation was, it was a beautiful looking woman, gorgeous clothing, but she was standing, honestly, the whole evening like that was her presentation. The pianist doesn't exist. The whole piano, can you imagine a big Steinway with was totally closed. Even the part of the piano where you put normally the scores on was closed. So the notes were flat on the piano. And the people after the concert asked me, how was the pianist? I said, honestly, I cannot tell you because I didn't hear him. And this kind of presentation, honestly, I think, is, thank God, is over. She's a very good teacher, by the way. I know that. But honestly, as a singer, I do not want to destroy the beauty of her voice that I have in my mind and that I have heard for many, many years, very often, with the most biggest joy. She was, for me, the Strauss soprano and gorgeous voice. But if it's over, I think it's more or less sad. Yeah.
You've always acknowledged that singing is competitive, that a singer has to find a place on stage and if necessary, fight for a place on the stage. I think you once left an agent because you thought she was favouring another baritone over you because she fancied him.
Yeah, but that would be really easy to say that that was the reason I left the agency, to be honest. It was also a relationship between us which was a little bit complicated. I mean, if you are at the beginning, I mean, then you have honestly to stay in a row. But if you are really established as a singer and you really have the feeling in an agency that another singer is prominently getting the concerts that you would like to sing, from time to time, I would not say always, but maybe one or two, and this is not going to happen, then you definitely have to think about if this is the right time to be at that agency. By the way, I went back then to the agency when another lady overtook her position, and she's now having her own business.
She's Helga Makaj. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm now with her since 6 years, and I love her like a sister. We have not a relationship between normally an artist and an agent. We are very, very, very close friends, and I definitely will finish my career with her as an agent because she is the best what ever happened to me as an agent and a human being, by the way, too, next to my wife.
When one looks at your range, which is from Bach to Boogie, I always tend to think of Brahms as being somehow at the center of it. I mean, not just that you have this North